Shavua to everybody. Just a brief introduction for both myself and everybody. It's the first time I think a lot of people in the room are meeting our guest speaker, Dr. Seaman. Rabbi Dr. Seaman, who is a professor at Emory University in Atlanta. Atlanta is a thriving community. It's really, I was there once, and it's a pleasure to have him here in Toronto. The weather's a little colder here, but it wasn't too bad.
But the people are
warm. There you go. He grew up in New York, and he did his undergraduate work at Harvard University. He got his PhD. He's been teaching at Emory for a long time. And this, of course, is the latest in our ongoing series on great influential thinkers. And really, I think it's been a wonderful series getting sort of an overview of some of the people who have shaped our identity. This is a little bit of a more modern personality we're going to do, and in a sense, a more tragic personality. And without further ado, Rabbi Doctor, Bakasha.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, both in Canada and here at Torah in Motion, which is an institution that has a reputation that precedes it. And I was always very jealous when I looked on the internet and I saw their list of speakers, and I said, I should be one of those people. And now finally I have the opportunity. So thank you very much for the invitation. And to Kilat Shari Torah and to Rabbi Kanofsky, who couldn't be here tonight, who also made it possible for me to be here. It's really a tremendous pleasure. When I spoke with Jay about topics for this talk, he told me that he would like me to speak in the series of, I think it was Great Jewish Thinkers or something like that. You know, Maimonides and Spinoza. And he said, we haven't done enough Chassidut. So I thought, okay, I can do that. I've written about Chassidut from a variety of perspectives, textual scholarship. I'm currently involved in an ethnographic study of North American Chabad and Israeli Chabad. And this is something that is very close to my heart, both academically and personally. And when I thought about who I should speak about, since the talk was supposed to be about a person and not a topic, as I understood, the only person that came to mind first for me was Rabbi Kalonymus Shapira of Piasecznia, and later of Warsaw, the Warsaw Ghetto. And I'll give you a little bit of introduction into who he is before we launch into the talk. My request is that if something is unclear, or if you have a question, please feel free to put up your hand and ask during the talk. And if I can, I'll answer it on the spot, and if not, we'll save some time at the end for more in-depth questions. And I will try to make myself heard, and please forgive me if I don't always. Rabbi Kalonymus Shapira was really, in a way, a kind of funnel collecting 200 years of Hasidic tradition, amalgamating it, synthesizing it, and putting it into a form that was meant to be understandable by 20th century men and women, mid-20th century men and women. He was above all an educator. We'll come to that in a moment. He was someone who was devoted to creating schools and to teaching pedagogy, although he didn't like the word pedagogy because it was associated with modernization and secularization. But when you look at what he did, he was a tremendous pedagogue and educational theorist. He died young. He had a very difficult, tragic life. He was born in 1889. His own father died when he was, I think, 4 or 5 years old. He was sent to live and be raised by a relative, the rabbi of Kozhnitz. He was also descended from the Magid of Kozhnitz. He grew up in that home, where he was exposed really to the crossroads of Hasidic thought and practice in Poland, and really imbibed, I think, from many different schools of Hasidism. When you read his books, you're impressed more than almost any other Hasidic writer that he quotes liberally. He quotes from around the spectrum. Some Hasidic books you read, they only quote from their own dynasty, their father and grandfather and so forth. He quotes everybody. Everybody from Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev to the Chabad dynasty. He quotes everybody, and he was in conversation with them. He was married young to a woman who became really his life partner in a very serious way. There are some of his written texts. Nehemiah Polin, who has written about him, has seen some of his manuscripts in which the handwriting changes midway through the text. And then at the bottom, there's a note that says, you know, I had to go off to do something. He was the rabbi, and my wife finished the drasha for me. Right? So we're talking about people who were not only helpmeets in the normal sense of the word, but were intellectually attuned. And this, by the way, shows up in his writing. His writings that touch on the topic of women and gender and Judaism are very striking, like those of his great-grandfather, for whom he's named, Kalonymus Epstein of Krakow, the Maor Veshemesh, who also is renowned for some very startling Torahs that, again, Nechemya Poland has written about egalitarianism in ultra-Orthodox Judaism, but that's not our topic for tonight. I just want to give you a sense of a person who lived with a lot of tragedy before the war started. It's no surprise to say that somebody who lived in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Holocaust had a tragic life, but his life was not easy before the war started. His wife also died young. They say he used to play a musical instrument. He stopped when his wife died, which was before the war, and he wasn't that old yet. And a lot of the Simchat Chaim, a lot of the joy of life that he had manifested, went with her. He didn't have many kids, and as we'll hear in a moment, they were all killed. And he had a very difficult life. But he was one of those people whose personal difficulties were almost transmuted into a kind of religious poetry in his work. And a big part of his life work of scholarship was figuring out how to come to terms with grief and loss and suffering before the war started. And then, of course, when the war starts and he's trapped in the Warsaw Ghetto, that takes on a special poignancy. Now, how do we know about Rabbi Shapira? Some of you are familiar with the Oneg Shabbos project, the diaries of the Warsaw Ghetto that were put together. There were people in Warsaw keeping track of what was going on, writing secretly, and burying the records. Well, Rabbi Shapira was involved with this group. He worked in a shoe factory, one of the Schindler shoe factories. And so in the top of the factory, there were people making shoes, and in the bottom was a yeshiva. And he and other people were teaching secretly in the bottom of the yeshiva in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he gave, among other things, weekly sermons in Yiddish. He wrote them down in Hebrew, as is customary, right, after Shabbos. And they were buried in metal milk canisters, together with other archives of the Oneg Shabbos program, which included secular historians, it included all kinds of things. Ringelblum, Emanuel Ringelblum, was the historian who ran the project. They were buried. As we'll hear in a little bit, Rabbi Shapira did not survive the war. And in 1960, Polish workers in Warsaw, if you've been to what used to be the Warsaw Ghetto, it's now the hub of the financial center of Warsaw, the big hotels, and that's where tourists go. And they were putting in a hotel, and they were digging deep foundations to the hotel, and they came across these milk canisters. And they opened them up, and they found texts with Hebrew writing. And by some miracle, they didn't destroy them. They sent them to someone who could read them. And on the writing, it says, "These should be sent to my brother, Yeshayahu, who's living in Palestine." And his brother was an interesting character by himself. His brother was known as Ha'admor HaChalutz, right? The pioneering Admor. He was a Hasidic rabbi who joined an agricultural collective in Eretz Yisrael, in Palestine. He was friendly with Rav Kook. He had died by that time himself. But his son, who now lives in, or now it's the grandson, I guess, in Beit Shemesh, got these texts published. And so the text I'm primarily speaking about tonight is a text called Esh Kodesh, Sacred Fire. And those are the sermons that he wrote between 1940 and 1943 when he was in the Warsaw Ghetto that were buried and that were discovered in 1960. That's what this text is. Now, during his lifetime, he also wrote copiously, mostly about the field of spiritual education. Of those books, only one of them, I believe, appeared during his lifetime. And that was a book we'll also have occasion to talk about a little later. It was called Chovat HaTalmidim, Student's Obligation. It's been translated into English, although the translation is now hard to get, by Micha Odenheimer in Jerusalem. And it's really an introduction to education for young children. The introduction itself to that book is worth spending a month or two reading. The book is written to 8, 9, 10-year-old boys, but the introduction is written to their teachers and parents. And in that book, which was published in around 1930 or something like that, He describes the state of Judaism in Warsaw at the time, not as we sometimes nostalgically remember it. He describes a world of growing and rampant secularization, of disaffection from Judaism, and in very strong tones, which it's hard to believe he was able to get away with at the time, he lays the responsibility for that at the foot of the religious leadership. He says, if people are leaving Judaism, it's because we're not doing our jobs. And that means we have to do our jobs differently than we've had to do them in the past. And so he begins to spin out a theory of education which is meant to answer the problems of modernity. We'll talk about that in a moment. And after that book, he went on and he wrote two or three other educational works for older and older Bachrim. And all of those works, except for the first one, were found in those buried canisters together with his Warsaw Ghetto writings. He also has a volume of drashot from before the war called Derech HaMelech, which is very much worth reading, although it hasn't received the attention of his Warsaw Ghetto writings. And this should really send a chill down your spine. As far as we know, his Warsaw Ghetto writings, as far as we know, were the last work of traditional Jewish scholarship ever composed in Poland. There may have been other things composed in the ghetto that were lost, but of the things that we have, that we can read, you're looking at the last traditional text after 1,000 years of Jewish tradition that was ever written on Polish soil. And so, for that reason alone, if for nothing else, this is a set of texts that have enormous historical value, but I think they have an even greater religious value and philosophical value, and that's what I want to talk about. Somebody have a question over here?
Oh, just
can
you give me the name of the book again?
The book from the Warsaw Ghetto is called Esh Kodesh, and parts of it have been translated as Sacred Fire, and there's another book about him called Holy Fire in English, but the Hebrew is called Esh Kodesh.
And the one before?
His first book that was published is called Chovat HaTalmidim, and in English it's translated as A Student's Obligation. Okay? I want to do something a little bit daring tonight, I think. I mean, I've written about this, I've published it academically, but I haven't often taught it before a Jewish audience like this. And what I want to do is not just go through some of his Torahs and talk about them, but I want to make an argument about what he was actually trying to do in his Warsaw Ghetto writings. And I think that it's often missed because it tends to be read in one of two different ways. Some people read his text as drushes, say something nice about the Parsha. It's moving because he was in the Warsaw Ghetto, but it's drushes. And so people don't always read him as having a coherent intellectual project, and I think he had a coherent intellectual project. And then some people read him in the light of the sort of we survived and triumphed narrative. Even some secular scholars fall into this. The Jewish spirit triumphed over the Nazis. That may be true on some level. I mean, that's a judgment, that's a value call. But he's not writing as somebody who triumphed. He's writing as somebody who very much understands that it's the end and that they're not likely to survive. And maybe nobody is going to survive. And there's a pathos and a desperation in his writing that I think pushes him to do and say things theologically that we still are grappling with today. And that are, on the one hand, much more traditional than any of the normal post-Holocaust theology. He was a Hasidic Rebbe after all. But at the same time are much more radical than what almost anybody is saying. And I think we have to grasp both of those, his deep commitment to tradition and his radicalism. Okay, so that's the introduction. As far as we know, he survived the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. He was one of those few. We know that in Pesach of that year, he was risking his life and going and baking matzah and collecting water for matzah for the Jews of Warsaw. He lived through the uprising. And he was arrested together with all of the survivors of the uprising shortly thereafter. They were sent off to different concentration camps. The Germans at that time became very nervous about uprisings because there were a few in different camps. And to the best of our knowledge, late in 1943, everybody in his camp was taken out and shot. That's the last we know of him. But there are two facts worth knowing. One is that when the Germans first invaded, he was given an option to escape, as certain rebbes were, and he refused to take it. He said, I'm not leaving my people. And then again at the end of the war, when they were in the concentration camp, he and a number of intellectuals, both rabbis and secular intellectuals who were in the same camp together, are reputed to have made a deal that none of them would leave unless they could all leave together. And that once again, he refused attempts to smuggle him out and felt that it was his job to stay and continue being a leader under those circumstances up until his death. I'm enormously privileged and humbled to teach his teachings, and I hope that I can do some justice to them. If you take a look at your handouts, and I'm sorry, I just didn't have time to type out the Hebrew, but the book is not expensive. You can buy it for $9 or $10, order it to your local bookstore. It's called Esh Kodesh, and the translations are my own. I wanted to start with his pre-war writings to give you a sense of who this man is, because people don't often do that. This is from the introduction to Chovat HaTalmidim. He says the following. Source 1. Why, in previous generations, did any type of education at all seem to suffice? It didn't matter what you did, the kids grew up from. The vast majority of every teacher's students and every father's children became servants of God, Ovdei Hashem. This is no longer the case today. The youth has arisen and considers itself mature before its time. Our sages have already warned us about this time from the beginning. In the time of the heralding of the Messiah, arrogance will multiply. Sometimes we are astounded to see little children bearing such a spirit of independence and courage that they seem to consider themselves to be grown men. So this is his diagnosis of the problem of modernity. He doesn't really explain it, but he points at it. And not just of Jews, by the way, he's talking about all of European civilization. And from his point of view, what has changed in the 1930s from what happened 100 years before or 50 years before is that youth is no longer willing to submit to discipline for discipline's sake by adults. It used to be that parents and teachers could tell their children what to do. And if they didn't have a good reason, it didn't matter. They could tell them what to do. And what's changed on a civilizational level, not just among the Jews, but the Jews are part of that, is that it doesn't work anymore. And he goes on to say that when you try to force children to do the right thing, by beating them or punishing them or any of the things that parents and teachers used to do, you know what happens? They think of you as the enemy. And they rebel. And by the way, they have someplace to go. Because they can join the Bund, or they can join the Zionists, or they can just leave the religious community or leave the Jewish community altogether. So there are options, and they don't think that you have the answers. That's 1930 Warsaw. Because they think in terms of there's a new world out there with new ideas, and you who represent tradition represent the old ways. Some of you in the room may have even had this experience with your own children. But the fact that you have this experience in 2012 in Toronto is a little less striking than the fact that this Hasidic Rebbe had the same problem in 1920 or 1930 in Warsaw. And he knew what he was talking about. He had founded a yeshiva in 1923, named after his father, Moshe, who had died again at a young age. And he was a committed educator. This is what he did with himself. He was an educator. And if you think about it, down the street from where he was living was Janusz Korczak, the famous secular Jewish educator, who was also thinking about the same themes at the same time. I have no idea if they ever spoke. What marks the educational theory of Janusz Korczak is that he says you have to teach children as moral agents. It's not enough to treat children as empty boxes you have to fill their heads with information. You have to treat them as moral agents. You have to convince them. You have to give them some autonomy. And it's quite striking that Rabbi Shapira, in more or less the same time and place, is making the same inroads in educational theory. Janusz Korczak, by the way, some of you may know his story, also refused to get out when he had a chance to get out and went to his death trying to protect his children. Children we're talking about. So this is the problem. If this is the problem, then what's the solution? So Janusz Korczak had his solution, which was grounded in secular educational theory. Rabbi Shapira had a different solution, which was grounded in Hasidic text and practice. Okay, how many of you have ever studied Hasidut in any kind of forum at all seriously? I know about you, yeah? Everybody else? A little bit. All right, so let's just say two words about Hasidism. Hasidism is a movement that grows up in Eastern Europe at the end of the 18th century, the Baal Shem Tov, the 1780s or something like that, in the Carpathian Mountains. It quickly takes over most of Europe. By the time of the war, the majority of Orthodox communities in Europe are Hasidic. I mean, that's just the in Eastern Europe, that's just the reality, with some holdouts in places like Lithuania. And there are many different schools of Hasidism, but they're joined by a couple of common traits, which we need to understand. One of the common traits that they're joined by is the admiration for the Rebbe, as a kind of intermediary figure between the Hasid and God, and loyalty to the Rebbe, and having an intimate relationship with the Rebbe. That's one thing. Another thing that they're joined together by is this intense fervor, especially of prayer. And in some texts, putting prayer above study, which didn't endear them to the Misnagdim. And finally, and most deeply, what Gershom Scholem called mystical psychology, which is the idea that they took the Kabbalah of the Middle Ages, the Ari, which was fundamentally concerned with what's going on in the heavens, and they translated it into a way of talking about what's going on in the soul. So all the same categories, Chochmah and Binah, right? Not talking about the heavens. I mean, it's also talking about the heavens. But what they're really interested in is how to use those as a way of diagnosing what's going on inside myself. It's kind of depth psychology. And different Hasidic groups did this in different ways. But all of them had this fundamental concern with the soul and the structure of the human psyche and with the power of the emotions in religious life. So you have a movement like Chabad that tried to influence it through the intellect first. And then you had most of the Polish Hasidim who were interested in starting with the emotions rather than starting with the intellect. Okay, those were the debates among the Hasidim. But they were interested in the purification of emotion as a way of coming to know God and as a way of becoming a better person, a better Jew. So in Source 2, also from Chovat HaTalmidim, he writes, "It's difficult for the youth of our generation, whose emotions, these are technical terms, hitragshuyot, and passions, hitpa'aluyot, have already been hardened and matured, to feel a sense of connection to religious principles through dry intellect alone. We must pierce through to their soul, to arouse and inflame it, and to allow them to experience the sweetness of even a slight illumination of the supernal light." Beautiful words, but for him it's not just rhetoric. What he means is, what does it mean that children think of themselves as grown up before they're grown up? It means they're hardened. They're hard to influence. They don't get excited very easily. They're a little bit cynical. And he says the job of education, of Hasidic education, is to arouse, to inflame the emotions and use them to carry the whole person forward. But you can't do that, he says, through simply talking to their intellect. You can't do that by simply giving them arguments or reason or kind of talking to them up here on the level of the abstract. You have to get to the whole person. And the whole person is here, mostly. It's not before you get to here, it's here. And so how do we, as educators in the 1920s or 30s, how do we get to here with these kids who are living in a world where their emotions are being pulled in very different places? What's exciting in Warsaw? Zionism, socialism, secularism, making a living. Those are exciting things. They get to your kishkas. So how do we turn Judaism, or how do we reveal within Judaism something that has that emotional power and fire? And then he says at the end of that quote, the sweetness of even a slight illumination of the supernal light, that's also not rhetoric. Okay, the Hasidic imaginary, the Hasidic psychology has it, that the human being and the divine are linked on a very profound level. The human soul and the divine are connected. So it's not just God is king and whatever, but it's chelak elokam im al mamash in the words of the Tanya, but the truth is all the Hasidim had different versions of this, that the human being and the divine are connected. And that therefore the arousal of human emotion is not just my emotion that's deep inside me, but it's a kind of reflection of what's going on up there with God. My emotions, if I understand them properly, are a tool. They're not a distraction. If I understand them properly, they're a tool for understanding God and understanding my relationship with God. Okay, we don't have time, so I'm not going to go into great detail with the psychology right now. If you have questions, I'm happy to at the end. In Source 3, he talks about the emotions. And here's what he has to say. And you have to read this part very carefully, because here he's really going to lay it out. "The narrow end of a funnel," he writes, enters the glass with its wide part, which actually contains most of the liquid remaining above, right? You have the image? Here's a glass, there's a funnel with the point coming down into the glass. Just so, divine light and holiness descend from the highest of worlds and are contracted in accordance with what the body has the capacity to receive. Okay, what's the metaphor here? What's the glass? The glass is the human body. The body is holy. He talks a lot about the body. Even in the Warsaw Ghetto, when he says, please save us, he always says, please save us both spiritually and physically. He's very into the holiness of the body. And the emotions, unlike a modern psychologist, which views the emotions as something that takes place somehow inside your psyche, for him the emotions are the overflow of divine vitality, streaming down to us all the time from above. And so you have to tap into it in the right way. And that vitality, we can't contain it all. Our bodies are narrow, ourselves are narrow. So we only can grasp what we can contain, but it's always coming down. It's always coming down. So it's a theory of divine vitality. This light, he writes, becomes clothed, right, or takes form, that's Kabbalistic language, as nishama, vitality-enabling thought in the brain, as ruach, vitality-enabling speech and emotion in the heart, and as nefesh, vitality-enabling animation in the liver. And by the liver, he really means the blood, right? The blood is the place where these things are. Each vessel receives only the kind of holiness that it's capable of receiving. So this is an understanding of human beings that incorporates the body and the emotions and the mind and the divine all in one holistic image. They're not separate. Human beings and God are not separate in the way that it's easy for us to think that we're separate. And in fact, the very thought that we're separate and independent entities is a problem to be overcome through prayer and study and mindfulness and other kinds of spiritual techniques. That's what Hasidism is. In its essence, according to Rabbi Shapiro, it's not just the ability to wear different clothes and to be very strict about what you eat and to live in separate communities. I mean, it's all that. But at its heart, it's a radical spiritual technique. And his argument is, we're going to lose the kids. Not that we have to modernize, but we have to reclaim the essential Hasidic teaching, which has become de rigueur. It's become about, you know, the hats and the clothes and the chadash and the whole thing, right? But there's a teaching there. Now, Rabbi Shapira studied a little bit of medicine. He was an autodidact. In fact, they say that at the local pharmacy, there was a local pharmacist who was a Jew named by the name of Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Shapira used to write prescriptions for people. And the pharmacy would fill them. And sometimes people would take the medications that he prescribed on the basis of having, you know, studied medical textbooks. And sometimes they wouldn't. And this is very interesting. They would ask him for a prescription. He would give them a prescription. What do you do if you're a chassid and your Rebbe gives you a piece of writing with his name on it? You save it. Right? So they would get the prescription, but they didn't want to fill it. They wanted the paper with the signature, and they would keep it close to them and hang it up, be a skula for healing. Okay? So he was very interested in the psychology of the day, as he understood it, and in medicine. You see that in Source 4. And this is all his pre-war writings. He's talking about the nature of a Jew. You know, one of the great anti-Semitic stereotypes that was out there, that's still out there today, is that Jews are very nervous. They're very effeminate. They're nervous. The Woody Allen stereotype. And Woody Allen happens to be Jewish, so I guess there's some truth to the stereotype. But that was a stereotype also here in Warsaw. And so he writes, he's responding to this. He says, he puts a positive spin on it. He can say, we can at least say that Israelites are by nature prone to nervousness. He's using the term here, atzabim. And sometimes in Yiddish, he says nerves, and sometimes in Hebrew, atzabim. He goes back and forth between them. He says, because they are descendants of prophets, the Jews, if they use this capacity for divine service, they can reach a very high level and even attain Ruach HaKodesh. If not, this is like the case of a person who is born with a powerful mind. When he does not use this intelligence, he risks madness. Thus it is that emotional excitement, hidrakshut, here's that word again, which is a preparation for prophecy, for exalted service through self-annihilation, ecstasy in the Holy Spirit, can also be transformed into nervous mischief and nervous agitation. So it's true, Jews are they're a little nervous, but it's only because they're not living up to their prophetic vocation. Right? Woody Allen is somebody with especially high prophetic capacities. And because he doesn't use them, you get what you get. Okay? So, but Jews are meant to be called to a higher and more exalted service. So the reason I gave you all this is because I want to point out that the thing that runs through all of his pre-war writings, and I could have brought hundreds of quotes, but all that goes through his pre-war writings is the need to stimulate people emotionally. People are dry. They're dead. They're not alive. You have to infuse them with spirit and vitality and life and inflame the emotions. There was a terrible depression, you know, some of you may have heard, right, in the 1920s and 30s. And people in Jews in Poland were committing suicide because they lost everything. And he writes in one of his pre-war writings, he says, you know what, the people who commit suicide are not the worst. The worst are the people who walk around like zombies. They're dead, but they're still walking around. And the cure for that is to infuse them with some of this Hasidic spirit. So all through his pre-war writings, he's very interested in a theory of the emotions, and he's very interested in training the emotions and helping people to get in touch with their emotions, to be more fervent. He says, in one of his writings to students, he says, you're going to reach the point where you can laugh and cry almost at the same instant. Right? Which to some of us sounds like a little bit crazy, like a little bit like we wouldn't want to sit next to a person like that on the train. Right? But from his point of view, that is a rung on the level to prophecy. And like every other 20th century Jewish writer, and before you object, I mean, including Rav Soloveitchik and including Heschel, including Rav Kook, including all of them, they thought prophecy was the end goal. They thought that everything we do is designed to make us closer and closer to the level of the prophet. Rav Soloveitchik writes that at the end of Halachic Mind, it's in Halachic, it's all over the place. Okay? So, but the Hasidim were more open about it. They didn't hide it in the footnotes. It was, you know, it was really out there. And the way to do that was by training the emotions. He wanted to get you excited. Now, why is that important to me here? 1939, the Germans invade Poland. In the initial German bombing campaign, his son is killed. He had a daughter-in-law who was visiting from Palestine. She was killed. Most of his community was destroyed. His mother died shortly before that, according to newspaper reports at the time, from a broken heart or a heart attack, depending on the version. So in that brief space, really just the beginning of the war, he already lost everybody close to him. Before concentration camps, before everything got started, he lost everybody close to him. And everybody in Warsaw lost everybody close to them, and it wasn't just him. The Hasidim said that, you know, his son died on the second day of Sukkot, and he led davening. It was Yom Tov, not allowed to mourn. He led davening with his usual exuberance. He said, Hallel, and he sang. But you can imagine what the cost of that is to a person. So suddenly, the person who for years has been pushing, we have to magnify people's emotional capacities, along comes the war, devastation everywhere. And you know what you have to do to survive? Deaden your emotion. Can't afford to feel too much. Can't afford to let it show too much. And so his whole spiritual teaching still is focused on the emotions, but he's got to flip it around. Because it's deadly. If you think too much about what's going on, you'll be like his mother. And I'm going to prove that now from his drashot. Take a look at source, we'll look quickly at source 5. He says, even now, while troubles multiply to such an extent that that's what you say, beards of Jews, not bears, I'm sorry, have simply been shaved off, leaving them unrecognizable on an external level, so too their interiority changes, leaving them unrecognizable from within. People don't know who they are anymore. The person loses and cannot recognize himself. He cannot feel the way he did a year ago on the Sabbath or on weekday before the prayers or during the prayers. Now he's trampled and crushed until he cannot even feel whether he is a Jew or a human being or whether he's an animal. He has no reality left to feel. He is lost. Okay, and this is part of a long drasha. I'm not going to get into the drasha right now. But this is a phenomenological description. Right? This is not, you know, you read now about, oh, the heroism and everybody was like they were dancing the horror the whole time. And right? That's not what this description is. This is a description from early in the war of someone who's broken, or at least is able to describe people who are broken. And it's only getting worse. I mean, it's only going to get worse from there. This is at the beginning. This is before they start deporting children. This is before they open concentration camps. This is before people are being sent to Auschwitz. All right, this is just the beginning. And he says, people don't know who they are anymore. They've been crushed. They've been trampled. They're lost. Now take a look at Parshat Chayei Sarah from 1939. This is a play on a drasha by his grandfather, the Maor V'Shemesh, who says some of this, but not the most radical part. He says, the word brit, covenant, is juxtaposed in the Torah with both salt and suffering. There are the verses. Just as salt in proper measure preserves the meat, but in excess makes it impossible to enjoy, so too suffering should come in proper measure so that a person has the capacity to receive it. Suffering should be blended with mercy. Okay, so far so good. If you were aware of it, this is all very Kabbalistic language, balancing the din and the rachamim and all that, that's in there. Seems to make psychological sense. So far, so good. Let's go on. Now he says something extraordinary. He says, that's why Moses, our faithful shepherd, juxtaposed Sarah's death in the Torah with the Akedah. It was in order to exonerate us, to show what happens, God forbid, when a person is made to suffer beyond measure. It was through excessive suffering that Sarah's soul expired. And if this true was true for Sarah, that great saint, that tzedeket agdola, who for all that was unable to understand, to withstand her harsh affliction, how much more so for us? Now, first of all, how do we know that Sarah died because of affliction? It's Medrash. The Medrash says, what happened? Why do we have the death of Sarah right after the Akedah? Because as Abraham is trotting up the mountain with his son, Satan, who has not been able to cause any problems with this journey, decides, he shows up in front of Sarah in the guise of Yitzchak, and he says, guess what Abba's doing to me? Right? Sarah, of course, Avram didn't tell her that he was going up to the mountain to shecht his son. Sarah is terrified, and she dies on the spot according to the Medrash. It's quoted in Rashi on the Parsha. Sarah, parcham nishmata v'meta, that's it for Sarah. So, but he's saying something quite extraordinary here. It almost sounds like biblical criticism, right? He says, Moshe put these two stories together, not because they happen one after the other, or necessarily at the same moment. Moshe put these stories together to give us an alibi. Because when you see that Sarah couldn't take it, what does that say about us? God needs to understand, we can't take it also. And there are going to be people who give up the ghost just because it's too much. And God should be merciful to them. Because they can't be expected. Yes?
Well, she also implying not just giving up the ghost, but giving up the front sex. Like,
yes, I think that there are two things that are going on here. Some people die, and some people become so dead to the world that, I mean, they can't learn, they can't do mitzvot, they lose their faith. I think he's talking about both. And now he goes on to say, so this was radical, but now he goes on to say something that I still can't even believe. It's also possible, he says, to suggest that Sarah herself, in taking Isaac's binding so much to heart that her soul expired, did so for the good of Israel. She sacrificed herself in order to show God that an Israelite cannot be made to suffer beyond measure, and that even a person who remains alive in his affliction through God's mercy must still lose portions of his vitality, his mind, and his spirit. What difference does it make to me if I suffer a full or a partial death? Well, think about this for a second. So, okay, we understood that Sarah died because it was too much for her, and Moses put the stories together so God would understand. Right? Okay, that's like interesting. But what does it mean that Sarah did this for the sake of the Jewish people? It means that Sarah had a choice. What was her choice? She could have not taken it so much to heart. We have a biblical example of that, Hagar. When her son is dying under the bush, she goes, oh, she sits aside, she can't watch. So if Sarah had done that, figuratively, just not, she could have watched TV all day, blocked it out, maybe she would have lived. But he's saying that Sarah becomes a kind of korban atzmit, a kind of self-sacrifice. She says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to engage in any kind of techniques to moderate my grief. I'm going to take it all in, the way only a Jewish mother can. To the extent that I'm going to die from grief.
I'm going to die from grief because I want to teach God a lesson. And God should know that you can't ask people to suffer beyond measure. That's sorrow. That's, by the way, a new kind of heroine that we've never heard about in Jewish history before. Think about this. The martyrs, the Jewish martyrs of Hanukkah, or the Jewish martyrs of the Roman period, or the Jewish martyrs of the Middle Ages. What made them martyrs? Rabbi Akiva, yo, please, I always wanted to say Shema, kill me. Right? They're courageous, they're brave, they're dying for a reason. That's not Sarah exactly here. Sarah is someone who dies by not being brave and courageous and all of those things, but by being vulnerable and subject to pain and grief-stricken. That's what kills her. But she finds a way to turn even that into a Kiddush Hashem. And if you think about it, although we call them martyrs, the people who died in the Holocaust, they're not martyrs like the people in the Middle Ages, for the most part. They weren't given a choice. They were killed. The Nazis didn't give them a choice. Renounce your faith, you can go free. They give them a choice. So Sarah is a representation of the new kind of Jewish suffering that comes into being in modernity, which is not about making a choice and standing up for your faith. It's just about who you are. And if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, it doesn't matter what you're... You know, Jewish Christians were in the Warsaw Ghetto. People who converted to Christianity were rounded up and killed. He knew some of them in the Warsaw Ghetto. Ringelblum talks about them in the Warsaw Ghetto. Ringelblum says, the Jewish Christians are walking around, they don't know what's going on. Like, the Jews at least understand they have a model, we're suffering because we're Jews, but these people converted to Christianity sometimes a generation ago. They don't know why they're here. They're like deer in headlights. So this is a different kind of martyrdom than the Jews have ever suffered before, and Sarah is the model. Yes?
So it's like Sarah in saying, Gamzo Latova, I accept your will, you know, I don't understand. She says something.
Sarah's death in this context, he's explaining as an act of protest.
Right.
But it's a protest through vulnerability. It's a protest through passivity, not really through action, which is fascinating. She did not say Gamzu
L'Tov. And that's very radical.
She did not say Gamzu L'Tov. That's a, you know, if you invite me back, I have a whole drasha about Gamzu L'Tov, which is also not the only position in traditional Judaism. But that's a subject for another drasha we'll come to.
Can you see that with Amram, too?
Okay.
He doesn't say Gamzu L'Tov.
Okay.
He divorces his wife.
All right, so you have to invite me back twice. I'll give that talk also. I agree. Yes, sir. Let's go on a little bit. Okay, source 7, I'm not going to read out loud. You can read it yourself. It's just a passage from the Jewish Daily Forward during that time that talks about what Rabbi Shapiro was doing. Source 7a also is from an eyewitness, Shimon Huberban, who witnessed Shavuot in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he wrote about what the Rebbe was doing there, dancing around with the Hasidim and crying at the same time. That's just for your information. Let's go to number 8. Parshat Tavo, 1941. Thank you. We can see now that we do not feel the pain of each affliction that comes upon us with the same intensity that we used to feel even minor troubles. This is talking about beginning to shut down. Moreover, we know that if we were to feel today the full pain of each affliction that comes upon us with the same bitterness and emotion that once we felt, it would be impossible, God forbid, to continue to exist for even one day. The simple reason for this is that, as our sages have taught, the dead flesh of a living person does not feel the scalpel. All that we feel, the italics are in the original, all that we feel is a crushing sensation throughout our bones. The world has turned dark for us, neither day nor night, just disorientation and confusion, as if the whole world were pressing down and crushing and compressing us, God forbid, until we burst. But we do not feel each individual torment, and you're absolutely right. This doesn't sound like Gamzu L'Tova. Now, in some of the drushas, a profound guilt begins to emerge, and it's important to understand that. Source 9. He says, even the person that God saves, Toldot 1941, even the person that God saves and revives from his trouble or heals from his illness lacks the heart to rejoice in his salvation. For although he's a Jew, and should he not rejoice that a Jew has been saved from death, still he dares not be glad. In his heart he thinks, if I rejoice in the fact that I have been revived, am I not in the category of one who says, I am and there is none but me? As if he did not take to heart the whole catastrophe of Israel,
and the masses of men, women, and children who still had many years of life ahead but now filled graves of earth as if they had descended alive to the abyss? What's he saying? He wrote this, by the way, after he recovered from typhus. He got typhus. You know why he got this? The German public health authorities, demanded that a wall be put around the Warsaw Ghetto so that the Germans wouldn't get infectious diseases from the Jews that were stuck in the Warsaw Ghetto. The typhus was every place. He got typhus. He recovered. A lot of people didn't. And he wrote this after he recovered. On some level, he is juxtaposing himself here to whom? I believe. I mean, I can't prove it exactly right now. He's juxtaposing himself with his mother, i.e. Sarah Imenu. His mother, who died of a heart attack when all this was going on, like Sarah, our mother, died because she took everything to heart. She felt the pain of the Jewish people. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Isn't that what they teach you in Hebrew school? You're supposed to feel the pain of another Jew? And he says, I survived. How did I survive? By not feeling the pain of another Jew. At least not completely. He says, if we were to feel it even for a moment, even our own pain, we'd die. We have to block it out. We have these strategies. We block it out. We don't think about it. So, but here's the problem with that. Doesn't that make me less of a Jew? Doesn't that make me less of a person? That I'm able to live like that and she had to die? So he's ambivalent throughout the war. He goes on, he's a communal leader, he leads davening, he leads Torah study, he's risking his life to bake matzah, I mean, he's a heroic figure. He's risking his life to take people to the mikvah. He's a heroic figure. But on some level, he's always troubled by the idea that if he was really in tune with the suffering of the Jewish people, he wouldn't be able to be here. And that maybe there's something wrong with him that he's able to go on under those circumstances. Now, in Hanukkah 1941, he rebukes the Jewish people. He sees that a lot of Jews in the ghetto are losing their faith. And this is what he says. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just read a little bit of it. He says, the truth is that there's no place for objections, God forbid, or for questions. It's true that the kind of afflictions we're now suffering come only once in a few hundred years. But how can one desire to comprehend these acts of God and become blemished in faith, God forbid, if one does not understand them? How can we with our minds seek to understand what God knows and understands? And why should a person become blemished from these afflictions more than all the tribulations that have befallen Israel since times of old? In other words, he turns on Hanukkah to the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. He says, get over yourself. I know it's hard. I know it's harder than your parents had. It's harder than your grandparents had. But you know what? Jews, we have a long memory. And if you go back and you read about the persecutions under Rome or the persecutions of the Maccabees, so Jews lived through some pretty bad things. So all of a sudden, you're going to come and say you're losing your faith because things are bad? Please wake up, get over yourself. It's a kind of a Musar drasha. It's actually unusual in the text, in the context of this book. He doesn't usually speak that way, but something must have happened in 1941 Hanukkah that he was upset about. But then at the bottom of the page, and that's really why we're here, here's a footnote, 10a. A footnote on the bottom of the page of his drasha from Hanukkah, and there he says, everything I wrote above, I'm sorry. He says, this was true only of the troubles that came up until the fall of 1941. But with the advent of the strange troubles and weird, evil forms of death that these wicked and strange murderers have brought upon the house of Israel since then, according to all my knowledge of the words of Chazal in the Chronicles of Israel, there has never been anything like them. God should have mercy upon us and save us from their hands in the blink of an eye. And he writes, the author, 18 Kislev, 1942. So something happened in between Hanukkah 1941 and Hanukkah 1942 that changed. By the way, we know what that was. It was the final solution. Up until the fall of 1941, the Germans were debating. Or at least the Germans on the lower levels didn't know that a decision had been taken. As far as we know, the final solution as we know it, which is the plan to exterminate every last Jew in Europe, really is only accepted somewhere in the fall of 1941 or the winter of 1941. By 1942, it's going full blast. The 1C Conference. The different historians have written that the Warsaw Ghetto went through several German governors during the period that it was the Warsaw Ghetto, and they had different policies. Some of them were trying to keep Jews alive as a workforce for the Germans. which was logical. They were making uniforms, they were working in munitions factories, and if you want to keep people alive, you have to at least feed them a little bit. You have to at least give them a little bit of something, right, to take care of them. But by this point, they replaced those governors, and the new governor understood that the policy was nobody should walk out of here alive. 300,000 Jews died in the Warsaw Ghetto. Do you understand what that is? 300,000 people in that one little area. So not all of them went to Auschwitz. A lot of them died right there in the Warsaw Ghetto because they starved to death, or they had typhus, or they were shot for some infraction, or whatever happened to them. So he sees people dying all the time. This is before what finally breaks him is the deportation of children. But that doesn't take place until later in 1942. And once they start taking the children away, that's like something he can't bear. That's toward the end of his writing. After that, he kind of stops writing. But I want to conclude by taking you to Parshat Mishpatim 1942. Because this is one of the key texts where he deals with what happens after you realize that what we're dealing with is something that no Jewish community has ever had to deal with before. This is new. And if you remember back to Parshat Chaye Sara, what he said was basically, God is kind of responsible for our suffering, and our matriarchs and our patriarchs stood up to God on our behalf. And he sort of takes the mode of protest prayer. Right, Sarah, Moshe, we're going to protest God's treatment of the Jewish people and make him listen. He almost never, except for that footnote, is one of the only places he mentions Germans anywhere in the book. What's happening to the Jewish people is between the Jewish people and God. The Germans are incidental. They're really incidental. But now what do? When it turns out that this is just so far beyond anything that anybody has ever conceived of before, something has changed. You can't keep to the same old theology. Something has changed. One of the things that makes this book special is that almost every religious writing that we have from the Holocaust that's been published was written outside. It was written by somebody who escaped to New York, like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, or it was written by somebody like Rabbi Teichsel, who was sitting in Budapest before the Nazis marched in. This is almost the only text we have that's written in the belly of the beast, not by somebody watching from outside. Here's what he says in Parshat Mishpatim. He changes his tune, and he does it throughout the whole second half of the book. He says, sometimes when a Jew is afflicted with suffering, he thinks that only he is in pain, as if all of his personal torment and the torment of the community of Israel do not touch on high, God forbid. But the verse tells us, it's from Isaiah, in all of their pains, he was pained. And in the Talmud it appears that when a person is in pain, what does the Shechina say? My head is too heavy for me, my arms are too heavy for me. In the sacred books, it's written that much more than a person is pained, God is pained, as it were, by what a Jew suffers. So now, all of a sudden, where's God in this story? God is not bringing about the affliction. All of a sudden, God is suffering with me. I mean, these are all quite normal midrashim. I mean, but he's emphasizing right now that God is suffering too. Then he goes on to say, it's possible that since blessed God is boundless and cannot be conceptualized within this world, so too his pain from the affliction of Israel is boundless. It isn't just that a person could never bear such great suffering as God bears, but that a person could never properly conceive of God's pain, never know his suffering, or hear his voice, woe is to me that I have destroyed my house and exiled my children. That's the Gemara in Brachot. So God is still responsible in a way. But I exiled my children and destroyed my house. But God is suffering right in there with the Jewish people. And more than that, God is suffering more than the Jewish people. Because God is infinite. And so his suffering must be infinite as well. Now what's the problem with this? Let's say God is infinitely, so what's the problem with this?
Why is he allowed?
Why is he allowed? Right? Step in, change it, blink your eyes, whatever you have to do, change it. Stop it. Or at least, let us hear something from you. I mean, the thing you read about in survivor testimonies again and again and again is their feeling of abandonment. Where was God? We thought God would step in. We thought God would say, it's humiliating. Where was God? And he has to have an answer to that. And we don't have time to get into it in great depth, but let's read the last paragraph. And again, the italics are in the original. The emphasis in the original. He said, if the voice of God's weeping were once to be heard in the world, the world would hear it and explode. Even a spark of God's grief in the world would scorch all of his adversaries. At the Red Sea, the Holy One, blessed be he, exclaimed, right, to the angels, "My handiwork, the Egyptians are drowning in the sea, and yet you sing praises before me? And now that it is the Israelites who are drowning in blood, how can the world continue to exist?" Now, the drasha goes on, that's all I brought here, but I want to explain to you what he's saying here. He's saying that there's a profound paradox, which is that God's silence, God's failure to make himself heard, is actually the sign of God's caring, and not the contrary. God is silent because, just like a person who has to rein in their grief because they'll go mad, God has to remain silent because if God was to intervene in the world, you know what? The world could not survive. God wants to destroy the world. He wants to wash it away, cleanse it like he did with the flood. But he's made a promise not to destroy the whole world. So he has to hold it in. Just like me, Rabbi Shapiro. God and me are kind of doing the same thing. We have to have a strategy of not taking it to heart as much as we could, because we have to allow things to go on and exist and hope that something better will happen one day. And in a paragraph I didn't bring here, if you want to hear God's weeping, because you need to hear God's weeping, where can you go to do that? In the text of the Torah. He says, when you learn Torah deeply, you can hear the voice of God's weeping inside the Torah. You can hear it inside the Torah. But the Torah is almost like a nuclear core. What does a nuclear core do? It's a technology that contains and controls enormous power and makes it useful instead of destructive. That's what the Torah is. The Torah is a place, Batei Gavai, it's a Gemara. The Torah is a place where God can weep, and instead of destroying the world, it has the capacity to fix the world. And he ends the drasha by saying, we should learn Torah, and we should pray, and we should try to fix, to sweeten the dinim, and to fix the problem, and God should redeem us in the blink of an eye. And that's one of his final drashot from the Warsaw Ghetto. Now what do we see here? Moshe Idel, who's a great Kabbalah scholar, talked about the Holocaust at the end of one of his books about Hasidism, and he writes, you see, the Jewish spirit triumphed over the German machinery. Now, I get that. I understand why it feels like something important to say. We want to feel like we triumph. Rabbi Shapira, his family, his whole world, everybody that he knew, gone. The civilization, gone. People survived. They went elsewhere. Judaism survives. But it's not the same civilization that he knew. And it's hard for me to think of that as a victor. And when I read Rabbi Shapira himself, what I find is he wasn't talking about the triumph of the spirit. He was talking about the fact that God is in the throes of grief and has to hold it in. Because if he doesn't hold it in, everything is going to be gone. And that's what a responsible person has to do. And that's what a leader of the Jewish people has to do. Sometimes you don't have the right to feel, even though you know that by not feeling, you're also doing something immoral. Because your job is to help people get from one day to the next day to the day after that. A few years ago, I was riding the bus in Jerusalem on my way home from work. I was at the Hebrew University at the time. And it was a fast day. It was, I don't know, one of the Taniyot. And as the bus is going through Mea Shearim, I see signs that there's a day of learning devoted to the Eish Kodesh in a yeshiva in Mea Shearim. So I got off the bus. And I went through side streets, and I found it, and I went inside, and I couldn't understand a word, because it was all in Yiddish. I'm not a Yiddish speaker. And there was something profoundly sad to me in that I couldn't understand. If Rabbi Shapira had been there, he would have been talking in Yiddish. So I was happy that survived. But on some fundamental level, the community that he was addressing doesn't exist. And the Hasidut that he was addressing doesn't really exist in the same way anymore. But his books have been publicized, and the word is getting out. And I'll conclude just by recommending to people, don't take what I have to say, don't take my word for anything. Please go out and buy the book, pick it up. You can also read my article if you want. There's the source at the bottom of the page. You owe it to yourselves to be in touch with one of what I think are the great thinkers of the 20th century and the Jewish people, who lived through, in a way that very few other people did, some of the worst events that humankind has ever seen and left something for us that's worth perusing. I'll take questions. Yes, please.
Two questions. How influential was he before the war?
So he was young. You know, he was born in 1889, so he wasn't very old, but he was pretty influential. His yeshiva was one of the largest in Warsaw, and so as an educator, he was quite influential. He was well known, but he didn't have masses of followers like the Gera Rebbe or something like that. So I would say he had an influence, but you know, he was written about at the time. You see, they were writing about him in the New York Daily Forward, so he was somebody people knew about him. You know, he didn't write those kinds of tracts. So, like, we don't have any writings from him where he's sort of telling you what he thinks about socialism or, you know, or any of these things. All we have are his grief that people are leaving religion. And, you know, I think that my guess is that if you could have shown him that you could keep religion and be a socialist or whatever... Because his brother was very much that kind of person. You know, he was a chalutz, and he was out digging the trenches in Eretz Yisrael and still functioning as a Hasidic Rebbe. And they were in touch with each other. They wrote to each other. He sent his son to Eretz Yisrael to be there and come back. So that's my guess just from what I know of the family. But no, we don't have any really explicit writings about any of this. His general way was not to criticize what other people were doing, but to try to show you what he thought you should do. That's really what he was about. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
God must withhold his grief or the world would be destroyed. I'm not sure what that means. Is that the only alternative? It's God, after all, we're talking about.
Right.
I'm not sure what that concept means theologically or practically.
Right.
I'd like you to explore that.
So, look, I think you have to realize that, first of all, he's speaking theologically, but he's speaking on a psychological level. In other words, part of what he's saying is that the divine, there's a concept called anthropopathism. It's a big word. It's like anthropomorphism, but of the emotions. So anthropomorphism is when you talk about the divine having human physical attributes. Anthropopathism is when you talk about the divine as having human emotional attributes. Or, of course, he wouldn't say that. He would say they're divine emotional attributes. And this is very much in line with the Kabbalah. Of course, it's not Maimonides. But they were very open and willing to say, you know, Maimonides is not the only person who ever wrote, and we don't have to agree with it. So what he's saying is that on the level of the sufferer, this makes perfect sense. If you give free rein to the emotions, you're finished. You're going to die. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's your great tzedeket like Sarah. But that's what's going to happen. Now, if that's true on the human level, then he thinks that it has to have a reflection in the divine. Because this is a basic part of the Hasidic theology, is that human emotional and cognitive reactions are reflected in the divine. So, for instance, before the war, he writes about anxiety. He says, you know what? When you feel a generalized anxiety and you don't know where it's coming from, like you think about it and you don't find a source for it, so you know what that is? That's God telling you that there's something going wrong, you need to do tshuva for something, right? But you know, the human emotions are connected. So, of course, on some theological level, sure, God could have made the world as, you know, flowers and candy growing every place. But God didn't. We can't really fathom why not. And within the strictures of the world that does exist, if God intervenes the way God wants to, he's suggesting, it'll be too much. And by the way, you know, he's reading Midrashim. I mean, that's really what he's doing. There's a whole genre of Midrash that have the angels, you know, talking to God about different things and accuse it, right? You know, like in the story that he quotes here, the angel, when the Jews are being pursued by the Egyptians, the angels come to God, they say, why don't you just destroy all of them? And God says, what are you talking about? They're my handiwork. So in Rabbi Shapira's understanding, the angels represent God's midat ha'emet. The angels represent that part of God's personality that's pure justice. On the level of pure justice, the world should be extinguished. But God doesn't want the world to be extinguished. So now you're getting into a very complicated thing. Do we want the world to be extinguished? I mean, if you had been around at the time, you could have pressed the button. Would you have? I don't know.
And yet he said earlier in one of the quotes with Sarah, was that there's only so much that you take. And
yeah.
You feel end of his life, he had reached that point.
Yes.
And I don't know what he would have said if he had survived the war.
I don't know either. And look, you know, we're not talking about somebody who's sitting around in a university, you know, library someplace, writing conceptual theology. We're talking about somebody who's giving drashot to a bunch of people who are about to walk off the plank, right, in the Warsaw Ghetto. And his job here is not to tie it up all neatly so that everybody understands the, oh, you know, that's why, you know, now you explained my kasha. His job is to allow them to go one more day. And I think the reading is that unlike many religious leaders who tried to sugarcoat it during this period, and many of the religious writings we have from great Torah scholars during this period, don't worry, it won't be so bad, God will protect us, I know when the redemption is happening, all that kind of stuff. He felt that you have to start by honestly describing what people are going through. You have to be honest. And the honest truth is despair. And then maybe you have a hope of saying something religious that's meaningful. But if you don't do that, then you're degrading them and you're degrading God's word, and you know it's just, it's a lie. So I think that part of his power is that unlike almost any other religious writer that I know of from this period, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. Sir? Oh, he was writing halacha, right? But unlike any theological or writer that I know of, he actually describes what it's like to be there. And that to me is precious, even though it's not a theology, like it doesn't translate. I couldn't just say what he said and turn it into abstract language. Oh, now I have a theology. Right.
The huge irony of people that he was railing about before the war, who left Judaism, were secular, were Bundists, left for America or for Israel,
yeah.
Palestine,
yeah.
Survived and thrived.
Yeah.
And those who didn't and were wrestling with God died.
Well, this is one of the great ironies, and I mean, irony is not the right word, but it's one of the great conundrums of that some Hasidim deal with and some don't. But not only did many of them not leave, but many of the rabbis were telling them, don't leave. And then this happened. So, I mean, it's an enormously complex problem for faith. Other questions? Yes?
Couldn't you consider his belief akin to Stoicism?
Can you consider his belief akin to Stoicism?
In other words, just take, in other words, like, you know, that's like a Stoic type of philosophy.
Well, you might, except that everything we know about him from before the war is he was against that. He wanted people to be exuberant. He wanted them to feel their emotions deeply. He wanted them to laugh and cry and be able to do that almost on a dime. You know, he wanted people to be able, when they go to tefillah, to experience deeply the emotions of whatever that tefillah was. And that's what we know about him, right? His son had just been killed, but he led the services on Sukkot with singing and dancing because that's the halacha. That's what you're supposed to do. So he didn't want people to be kind of, you know, Spock-like.
His view changed.
His view changed or the necessities of the moment changed. I mean, if the war had ended, he might have gone back to what he was saying before. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yes, sir.
So, an observation, if I may, in his early Shoah writings, when things were bad, but perhaps he saw them as another terrible event in Jewish history, but it was just one in a series.
Right.
So he seems to hold God to account.
Yes. I'm repeating your question for the recorder. So at the beginning of the war, when he's writing about things that are going on that are terrible, but maybe a continuity with Jewish history, so he's willing to hold God to account.
Right. In his later Shoah writings, when things were really bad, and he recognized that the Holocaust was a special event, I mean, he seems to let God off the hook.
And in his later writings, he seems to let God off the hook. Yeah. So, look. Sure. And you know, I think there you could, if you want, read this as propositional theology. And you could say, oh, here's his claim, true or false, you know, mark it off. And you could use it that way. But what you're talking about is somebody for whom God is not a concept. God is a person in his life, in an incredibly real sense. You know, some of us, I mean, it's not the same thing, right? Some of us have been disappointed by our parents, right? So at what point do you decide to write your parents off? That's not an easy question to answer. And you don't do it simply or easily, and you keep looking for ways to understand what's going on in a way that makes sense. Sometimes you reach that point. And again, I don't know what would have happened if he had survived the war. I can't tell you how he would have wound up. But God was a person. He was real. And everything that he knew, everything that he was devoted to, was about being intimate with God. So his problem was not, does God exist or not exist, or how do I explain suffering? His problem was,
how do I maintain intimacy with God? So there's intimacy in revolt. There's intimacy in holding God to account. But there's only so far you can push that. And so he was looking for a different kind of intimacy at the end, which was almost a kind of mystical consciousness. You know, in that last drush in Parshat Mishpatim, what I didn't include here, he says, and you know what? When you read the Torah deeply like this, you begin to hear God's voice from the cows lowing in the field and from the birds chirping in the air. I mean, he's describing a mystical consciousness in which you begin to see God as present in everything. And by the way, that has to mean also in the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, that's hard for us to get our heads around. But for somebody of profound mystical faith, that's the natural next step. And suffering pushes you in that direction. So it's important, not necessarily, I mean, I'm not standing here saying we should all walk out and adopt his point of view. I mean, if it's resonant for you, it is, and if it's not, it's not. But what I'm saying is, it's worth trying to think yourself into this position for at least a moment, because this is the only testimony that we have. Yes?
Last month, there was Holocaust education week, and there were, one of the lectures was given by Rabbi Tao. He was a former rabbi of the Big Shul up in And his topic was the legacy of memories, and he was reading from different diaries that,
yes,
that were found in the Huntsman Granny, and one of them was Rabbi Shapira.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned the Shabbat Shuva drasha that he gave, I'm not sure when, but in it he says Jews have to be Shuva, but he also said God has to be Shuva.
Yes, that's why it's called Yom HaKippurim. It's in the plural, he says, because just like we have to do Tshuva, God has to do Tshuva.
Right, so that must have been earlier, because it sounds like
that's
at
right.
The end,
that's right. It was. It was. In other words, I'll finish this question and we'll end, but if I had to say it this way, in the early drashot, God is standing outside the action, kind of causing it to happen. That's the standard God of Jewish theology.
Yeah, but that doesn't fall without God knowing about it. So it's kind of, isn't that a contradiction?
I don't think so.
And then he's standing outside of it when everything that the bird falls, you know.
No, but it's both. It's both. Look, if you just read the prayers that we say on Rosh Hashanah, it's God is king, and God is going to do this, and God is going to do that. It's God looking in on the world. That's what the prayers read like. The Hasidim had a panentheistic or a mystical view of the world in which everything is part of God. But they're both true. It's not that one is true and not the other. They're both true, and it depends on the perspective. It's like light. It's a particle. It's a wave. It depends how you're looking at it. So that's what the divine reality is like. It's like God is king, but God is also part of everything, and it depends on the glasses you're wearing at the moment. Okay. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you coming out on Erev Chanukah. And although it may seem odd for me to say this, please have a happy Chanukah.
Yeah, I was going to say, no hespedim are allowed on Chanukah. So to cheer us up a little bit, in the back are refreshments. It really was a pleasure having you. And Emir Tashem, we will have you back in the future. And
I really have topics.
I gotcha. So thank you very much. And Chanukah Sameach, and enjoy your Sufkaniyah and Shmooz. And I guess we have triumph. That's what Chanukah is about. We have triumph. That aspect of the
Thank you.